It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the Vineyard as Test Lab. Fetzer Vineyards is testing a new business model for corporate California winemaking. It's an ancient approach, organic and sustainable agriculture, but on a grand scale. Remember vase or vase? Well, the Stern Settle the meat pie debate. Is it Cornish pasty or Cornish pasties? Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby has a rice we cannot mess up. It's supposed to be sticky. Then we have the son of, the revenge of, and the return of the shellfish most folks forgot, the abalone. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Today we hear about what could be the new way of wine, American wine, that is. We talk with Fetzer Vineyards' Paul Dolan about how a big corporate winery goes organic and sustainable and still stays profitable. Then it's the rice a rookie cook can love. It is supposed to glom together. Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby talks about Asia's sticky rice. I think of it as the new finger food. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hey, you two. Good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Hi.
I have a question. You've got to settle something for me once and for all. Cornish, the Cornish things, you know, the crust on the outside and meat and vegetables on the inside. Now, are they called pasties or pasties?
Neither. The pasties. All right, Lynn, let me back up and start here. Pasties are what strippers wear. Pasties are Cornish meat pies served in Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
But are they still being made up there?
You know, it's interesting, Lynn. When we started traveling around the United States maybe 20, 25 years ago, everywhere you went in the Upper Peninsula, there were pasty shops in every town. Every bakery made pasties. Many restaurants served them. In recent experience, we found fewer and fewer Cornish pasties in the Upper Peninsula. I think it's one of those kind of old world dishes that newer generations tend not to value as much as the older people. However, if you're going to Traverse City, Michigan, there is one place that does honor the pasty and makes some really wonderful ones. It's called Cousin Jenny's Cornish Pasties.
In fact, pasties really were kind of the original fast food. They were meat pies that miners would take down into the mines with them and have for lunch because they were easy to eat and easy to put in your pocket. But there aren't that many miners down in mines anymore. And as Michael said, the pasty tradition has started to kind of disappear, but Cousin Jenny's is really a stronghold of it and has brought back the best of it.
And in fact, I should say that the name Cousin Jenny comes from the tradition of the miners being known as Jacks and their wives being known as Jennies. So Cousin Jenny means, you know, the Cornish woman who makes the pasties to give to her husband when he goes down into the mine.
Is there a particular formula to this? I mean, is it always beef or always chicken? And
The most traditional one is a pasty, which is, you know, a flaky crust stuffed with beef, potatoes, onions, and rutabagas. But Cousin Jenny has maybe seven different varieties, including breakfast pasties, which are Swiss cheese and ham and eggs and hash browns. I mean, they have all sorts of varieties.
Like what other stuff? What other kinds?
Well, you can get a German pasty, which is ham and sauerkraut and Swiss cheese in a crust that has a kind of a rye caraway flavor to it. Or there is an Italian pasty. Talk about cross-cultural. And this, of course, it actually resembles the pepperoni roll of West Virginia, if we really want to get technical here.
Or that calzone.
Yeah, or a calzone. It's pizza sauce and pepperoni stuffed inside the crust. Of course, the crust is closer to a pie crust than it is to a pizza crust.
Every nationality, I think, has their own version of a pasty. And it just occurred to me how these really are very empanada-like. They're kind of bigger and heavier than empanadas. But it's kind of the same deal. You know, it's the flaky crust that, you know, holds a nice juicy filling.
It's almost, I mean, one other way to look at it is it's the English burrito in one regard, just holding everything together.
Yes, that's
right. Is there anything else in Traverse City that we shouldn't miss?
Cherry pie, or apple pie, or for that matter, any other kind of pie. There's a place there called the Traverse City Pie Company, And you can, they have a few tables where you can sit down and get a wedge of pie and eat it there. Most of the businesses take out. These are really superior pies that remind you that, in fact, Michigan is a great fruit farmland, and a lot of, you know, berries, apples, and cherries are harvested there. They go right into these pies, and they're some of the best you'll ever find.
So if you want to eat like a Stern, you'll have meat pie for lunch followed by pie for dessert.
This isn't a bad idea. Hey,
the all-pie diet. I like that.
This is, could put Atkins out of business. Hey, thanks, guys.
Okay, bye.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I'll admit, Cornish pasties are good, but I have got to chime in with yet another take on the meal in a crust. And of course, guess where I am taking you? To Italy. Now, if you go down to the heel of the boot, the Puglia region, you will be in veggie heaven. Nobody does vegetables like the Pugliese. Now, when you're there, you go to this olive estate slash guest farm called Il Frantoio. At dinner, you will be served their pizza rustica. Now, have to imagine a big, round, two-crusted pizza. Inside is this fabulous filling of cheese, thick onion tomato sauce, chunks of black olive, and sweet currants. It's kind of sweet-sour, wonderfully messy to eat with your fingers, and it's great reheated. So check out the website for my pizza rustica recipe. It's splendidtable.org. Oh, and while you're there, take a look at signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers at Organic Valley. Every week we send you a new recipe for a fast weeknight supper, technique, and shopping tips. But best of all, it's free. So, splendidtable.org. John Willoughby is what you might call a food writer's food writer. He's a consummate researcher and recipe developer. He's done books with his pal Chris Slazinger that keep winning awards. And he happens to be executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. John, good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Lynn. It's great to be here.
So, John, what's piquing your interest right now?
Well, I have a renewed interest in food that I discovered about 8 or 9 years ago when I was in Southeast Asia, and I had sort of let it slip out of my consciousness, and it's back. And that is sticky rice.
Sticky rice?
Sticky rice, also called sweet rice and glutinous rice, neither of which are actually very apt, but we can get back to that. But sticky rice in most parts of Asia is used largely for desserts. But in northern Thailand and Laos, it is used as if it were bread. I mean, it is integral to their cuisines as bread is to French cuisine. The way they use it is that they steam it. You steam this rice instead of boiling it. And then they use it. It's served at every meal in these little conical baskets. Everybody gets it in a little individual basket. You roll it up into balls, and you use it as if it were bread, to dip into gravies, to pick up little pieces of fish or meat or whatever you're eating. Always you have sticky rice, and it's really got a great flavor. It's much nuttier than most other rices, and it has a nice texture, just slightly chewy, so that it's got some substance to it. It's a wonderful accompaniment to almost anything, and particularly to any kind of Southeast Asian meal.
So I mean, this does exactly the opposite of what we're always told. Rice isn't supposed to be fluffy, and you see individual grains, and this gloms together.
You want it to glom together. That's exactly right. And what you do is you soak it. It needs to be soaked for 6 or 8 hours. And the reason for that is that its whole character comes from the fact that it's very high in amylopectin, which is one of the two starches that are found in all rices. Now, it's called glutinous rice, but it doesn't have any gluten in it. What it has is this amylopectin. And because of that, it doesn't absorb much water when it cooks. So you need to soak it so that it absorbs enough water, swells up, becomes tender. And then when you cook it, instead of cooking it in water, as you often do with rice, you cook it in a steamer over boiling water, because that's the only way it really gets enough heat and absorbs enough moisture to become very tender.
So it has to be in something perforated sitting over boiling water?
It does. You can use a colander sitting over a pan of boiling water. If you have a rice cooker, most rice cookers come with a steamer inset. You can use that.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing to use, if you happen to have one, is a Laotian rice basket, which is a very attractive sort of conical, tightly woven basket that they put over a big special pot that they use. And it's fun to cook it in that because it also looks great in the kitchen. But you can cook it in any kind of steamer or, as I said, just in a colander set over boiling water.
Okay. And how long does it need to cook?
About 20 minutes, 20 to 25 minutes until it's just tender. And the other thing they do with this, which if you do this and add this to your food, people will not know what it is, but they'll know there's something very intriguing about what they're eating. They take the sticky rice and cook it in a saute pan just until it's browned. It takes about 4 or 5 minutes over moderate heat.
Is this
to shake it back and forth?
The cooked rice?
Nope, this is the raw rice.
Uh-huh,
you just brown it, and then you grind it up to a powder. You don't want it too fine there, it'll clump together, but just until it's kind of a crumbly powder, and then you add it to all kinds of things. We have used it recently for a catfish wrapped in banana leaves, which we just rolled in a sticky rice powder before we put it in the banana leaves.
Ooh.
And it's got this nutty sort of exotic flavor that no one can quite place, but that is really wonderful. So I've started doing that more and more just to add that little under flavor to all kinds of things.
By the way, this is always a white rice, right?
Always a white rice.
What about desserts? You said that it's used for desserts in Asia.
Well, it is used in a lot of places for desserts, and the easiest and most delicious to my mind is if you first cook it, then you sort of put it in a pan with some coconut milk, and you can put in a little jasmine flavoring if you want, or just coconut milk, and just cook it till it's kind of mushy, and then you wrap it around mango. And serve it like that. So you have that nutty rice with the rich, sweet coconut and the mango, and it is wonderful.
Oh, that sounds so easy. You can do that ahead, right?
Absolutely, you can do it ahead. And if you want it to be even easier, you can just put the mango on top of a little pile of the coconut rice, and you don't even have to wrap it up. It's just, it's fresh, it's refreshing, and it's also a little sweet. It's really great.
And I'd imagine in summer you could do that with peaches and nectarines and stuff, too.
Absolutely.
Hey, John, thank you. Sticky rice. Okay.
Thank you.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. He left us with the perfect entry-level recipe for steamed sticky rice, as well as directions for that toasted rice powder that he mentioned. Now, you can do all kinds of things once you have these two recipes. You can find them both on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, fermenting a business revolution in the vineyard and the comeback kid on the meat counter. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. Fetzer Vineyards has been going strong in California for decades. They produce about 4 million cases of wine a year. Fetzer is also what you could call one of the test labs for a new approach to doing business, one that could change the American wine scene. The approach is called sustainable business. We're joined by Fetzer president and winemaker Paul Dolan, author of True to Our Roots, Fermenting a Business Revolution. Paul Dolan, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be on the show.
Paul, you have been president of Fetzer's for 10 years. Now, when you took over, it was a going business. I mean, it was practically a household name, right?
Right.
Why did you make a change?
Well, I guess I was going through a life change for myself. I was sort of at a period of time where I was kind of questioning what's really important to me, mm-hmm. What's next for me. And I had, as a winemaker, I had noticed and recognized that there were some things about growing grapes and making wine that just really didn't set well for me. And I was starting to move down a path of looking at organic and using less chemicals. Actually, I can remember as a young winemaker walking through vineyards and tasting the fruit off of a Sauvignon Blanc vine and tasting all the fruits and melon and fig flavors that I would expect. And then just walking a few vines over, just the next row, and tasting the fruit off another vine, and the fruit was flat and insipid. And I never could understand why that occurred. What would cause that to be that way? And I always had great hopes for that wine. And I would be disappointed most every year, and the wine would go into our everyday table wine. But after converting that particular vineyard to an organic vineyard, 3 years later, that same fruit was going into our top-level Sauvignon Blanc. So I started to see that there was a way to grow grapes better, a better quality, and improve our wines. But I also saw that there was something that we were probably doing with the chemicals that was causing some negative impact, if you will, on the ground, on the soil, which was killing the microbiological life in the soil, killing those little bugs in the soil, which are so critical for the health of the vine itself.
But what did doing organic grapes mean for the business? I mean, it's a more expensive way to work, isn't it?
Well, you know, initially we did see some additional expense because we didn't know how to do it. It was brand new for us. And so we kind of bumbled along a little bit, and a lot of it was trial and error. And so from that standpoint, it was a little bit more expensive. But today, after farming this way for several years, probably 15 years, we find it actually is cheaper, less expensive to farm organically because we get better productivity and better quality as well. So that's the interesting message, I think.
Did it affect any other aspects of the business at that time?
Well, it's impacted all of our business now. We started to see that once we started doing things a certain way, we recognized that there were more things that we could do. Mm-hmm. When you start to see that, my gosh, you can't use chemicals in the soil, we started to say, well, we can't probably use chemicals in the winery. And before you know it, we were eliminating all of the different cleaning chemicals that we use, and we just found other ways to do things. We now buy 100% green power in the winery. There were many, many, many things that we're doing in the winery now. It's really shifted our whole perspective to business in general.
You know, at that time, 10 years ago, Brown Forman, a large corporation, bought Fetzer. Now, how did this approach go with that corporate culture? I mean, I think of this approach to making wine or making anything, perhaps going against a corporate culture.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you know, we all have that big concern as to how corporations run their businesses these days. But Brown Forman is a very socially conscious business, and they like every business. They have a particular drive, and that's to always continuously improve the bottom line. Mm-hmm. Well, we were growing as a business, and we were doing very well financially. And so there was room for us to kind of go on this quest for sustainability. We were in a discovery process. But the interesting thing is everybody thinks it costs so much to do those things. But mm-hmm. in reality, it's really more of a mindset change than anything, because there's lots of ways that we can do things more environmentally and socially conscious than we were before.
Well, you know, you've developed this idea, though, through the 90s, which was a time of boom. But from what I understand now, there's more wine out there than there is consumers, and profits are down. How do you think it's going to play in the future?
Well, You're right. During the 90s, it was a boom period, and so we were very strong financially. We operate our business on what we call a triple bottom line. So we have the economic bottom line, an environmental bottom line, and a social equity bottom line. We call it E3, the three E's. And we look for a balance, but right now there is more pressure on the financial side. So we're spending more time on trying to kind of improve the dynamics of the financial, probably spending less time on the other two E's. And that once we get the economic side squared away, then we'll go back to developing. And it's not that we've stopped anything. We just haven't had this. We don't have the same kind of rate of development in the other two E's. I think other businesses are going to experience the same thing. But interestingly enough, I think your question is, well, are we going to continue to go down this path of sustainability?
Mm-hmm.
We are, of course, but the industry is very involved in sustainability as well. The whole California wine industry has embraced it. The industry has written a code of sustainable wine growing practices. It's a 500-page self-assessment guidebook.
Huh.
And we've had, in 1 year's time, over half of the wineries in California have already gone through the self-assessment. And so this conversation of sustainability is a very, very strong conversation inside of our industry right now.
We're in a time of great change. Paul Dolan, thank you.
Thank you very much. It was great.
Paul Dolan is president of Fetzer Vineyards and author of True to Our Roots, Fermenting a Business Revolution. David Rosengarten has done it all, or nearly all. He co-authored a groundbreaking book on pairing wine with food. He was a pioneer on the Food Network. He's done several cookbooks. His latest is It's All American Food. And he has a newsletter called The Rosengarten Report. David, good to have you with us.
Excellent to be here.
So what have you been digging into lately?
Well, I am a lover of breast of veal, which is not something that you see that often across the U.S.
No, you don't.
So I am here as Mr. Breast of Veal Advocate to tell you that it's hard to find a less expensive cut of meat that is as good as this. It costs like $2 a pound. And when you buy a whole breast of veal, and the thing naturally is 9 or 10 pounds, you cook it for a whole mess of people, a whole big dinner party, and, you know, you've spent like $20 for the meat for like 12 people, and it's amazing. You can take the whole breast and have the butcher put a pocket in it, and then you stuff that pocket with some kind of great stuffing. I like to do something with cheese and rice and spinach, a kind of northern Italian kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can ask the butcher to cut the bones out of the veal breast, and then you have a boneless veal breast, which is about a 3-pound piece of meat, and you stuff it with something interesting and roll it up and roast it or braise it like that. However, the thing that really got me into this subject this year was a dish that I had recently at a restaurant in New York City called, the restaurant's called Fleur de Sel. The chef is Cyril Reynaud. He's a brilliant young French chef from the north of France. And he makes what he calls a confit of veal breast, which of course in French means preserved. But it's not exactly preserved. But what he does basically is he sears it, and then he braises it in the oven for a very long time, like 3-4 hours. So it's the bones are practically falling out of it. You take it out of the oven, you let it cool, and then with your fingers, you just pull those big bones right out. You cut it in half, and now you have two big chunks of very tender meat. He stacks them on top of each other.
Uh-huh.
He weights them overnight for 24 hours or so. And then you have this incredibly compressed but incredibly tender, velvety piece of meat. He then cuts it into little squares, and he sautés the squares in a very hot pan so they get all crispy, crunchy on the outside.
Oh, brother!
And serves it with a sauce or with wild mushrooms or with, you know, lentils or mashed potatoes or something. Lynn, it is one of the best things I've ever put in my mouth. It's fantastic.
You know, what I'm thinking is you can do this. You can have it in the fridge.
Yeah.
I mean, you could do it for a party or whatever, but you could do this and have it in the fridge and you could eat off of it for a week.
Well, you absolutely could. And you know what? You don't even have to heat it back up. Like, you don't have to sear the cubes.
Right.
You could just cut slices off it and make great sandwiches from it, too.
So what does this breast of veal look like? I'm picturing, does it look like a rack of spare ribs?
You know, it looks something like that, except it's both wider and longer and meatier. The rack of spare ribs, of course, you know, you see those bones everywhere. In the breast of veal, the bones are more sort of surrounded and insulated by lots of veal meat.
So this is worth checking out. So I wonder if you could probably special order it, too. If you live in an area where you don't see it.
Absolutely. In my newsletter, I've got all the information on where to get it through the mail. And listen, $2 a pound. I mean, that's crazy these days.
Yeah, that really is pretty good. Yeah. But I love this idea of you cook it, and then you can do that a couple of days ahead, and you stack it, and you press it. This is dynamite. Hey, David, thank you.
My pleasure.
David Rosengarten is creator of the Rosengarten Report newsletter. You can get that recipe for veal breast in the style of fleur de sel on the website, splendidtable.org. Back in the 70s, abalone, the big-shelled mollusk from California, was classy eating, right up there with caviar and hearts of palm. Then it disappeared. But, great news, it's back again. Mary Stuckey has a report.
San Francisco chef Ross Warren slips the thin medallions into an egg wash.
It's gonna be quick.
Gently drags them through breadcrumbs and slides these precious pale discs into a sizzling skillet of clarified butter. He says abalone must be treated with the utmost speed and delicacy.
There's one. There's two. There's three. There's four. Okay, turn the heat off. Squeeze a little lemon on that baby. Hit it with the parsley. Put it on the plate.
The cost? $34. And that may be the best deal in San Francisco. It costs almost twice as much downtown. Here at the Pacific, a classic neighborhood seafood cafe, 16 wooden tables, chalkboard specials. They've been serving abalone for 30 years. On the walls, iridescent abalone shells, bigger than a man's hand, from the days of commercial fishing when abalone was plentiful in the ocean. Today's farmed abalone is only about 3 inches long, but just as popular with diners.
Oh, I love it. Yes, that's one of our favorites. If you're going to go for a dinner out, that's what you do.
It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. It's it makes calamari kind of taste. It's like the difference between a jug wine and a good Chardonnay is the difference between calamari and abalone.
Wild abalone was available until the outlawing of commercial fishing more than 6 years ago, after dramatic declines in the abalone population, due mainly to overfishing. Back in the old days, Chef Warren bought abalone from a man who dove for it using scuba gear.
Our supplier, who was known as Deep Diving Frank, out of Half Moon Bay, and he'd come up here, you know, once a month, and he got put out of work along with lots of other commercial divers. They fought it for years, but finally they put a ban on it, and that was that. I think he's a dog trainer now.
This is a look at the seawater as it's first being pumped in from the ocean.
But Deep Diving Frank's misfortune was incentive for scientists who spent years of trial and error learning to farm abalone, which are successfully grown here in 50-gallon tanks off a windswept beach south of San Francisco.
The seawater is pumped in from the ocean through the tanks and then back out. That is to create a very natural environment in those tanks. All we try to do is create the same environment as the ocean in the tanks where abalone are. Same water, same food, just all natural.
Jim Webb is CEO of U.S. Abalone. It's a tricky business convincing the critters to reproduce in these tanks, according to Tom Ebert, whose father was a pioneer in developing the science of abalone farming. Unlike some other fish, abalone do not concentrate toxins in their flesh, an advantage for consumers and, says Tom Ebert, farming abalone does not hurt the environment.
We don't use chemicals and artificial feeds and those types of things that could go directly back into the environment. We do extensively testing of our discharge water here, and it's always really very high quality water that's even been discharged here. So that's not an issue.
Ebert works alongside Jim Webb at U.S. Abalone.
Let me actually pull out
if I can. This is an abalone at about 3 years old.
On top, it looks like an ear-shaped shell, but on the bottom, no shell, just a muscular foot. That's the meat, prized not just here, but also in Asia, where it's a sushi delicacy.
In Japan, there's nothing better than pointing to that live abalone you want in that tank and watching them pop it out of the tank and then prepare it right in front of you.
I think I'd prefer my abalone cooked in the manner of Chef Ross Warren.
One order of abalone for you.
I got a couple of rock stars that come in here and order abalone several times a month.
Who do you?
No, I'm not saying. I'm not saying.
Oh, you all say.
No, I'm not saying. This is... We preserve privacy here.
Now that makes sense. Rock stars would be interested in such an exotic treat. And they could afford it.
Reporter Mary Stuckey is based in Minneapolis.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me. Don't be afraid, you can.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have got Leslie calling from Oklahoma City. Hey, Leslie, what do you want to talk about? What's
up? Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call. This is a treat.
You are welcome. You are welcome.
I have a little bit of a problem. I just really love to cook with morel mushrooms.
Right.
And I am lucky enough to be able to find fresh morels in the forest around here this time of year. But all my recipes call for dried morels, and I would like your help on how would I substitute the appropriate amount of fresh morels...
To the dried ones?
To the dried ones.
Okay, with dried mushrooms, generally, it's 2 to 3 times the fresh to the dried. So if it calls for a half a cup or... 3 pieces, let's say, for argument's sake, 3 dried morel mushrooms, you would use 6 to 9 fresh morel mushrooms. So that's the basic balance.
Okay.
The other thing is that you want to look at the recipe, because when you have fresh morels, they're so delicate and they're so special. Some of the dried morel recipes may have long cooking,
mm-hmm.
may have them cooked into a lot of complicated spices and seasonings.
Mm-hmm.
And with fresh morels, you want to cook them until they're tender. But you don't want to fuss with them too much because they're so good on
they
their own.
They are so good. Such a treat.
They really are. My favorite way when I can get my hands on them, I saute them in butter. And then I add a little bit of cream and I reduce it down with maybe just a spot of white wine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I top them with toasted hazelnuts.
Oh.
Or slivered, salted almonds crushed, and they're so good.
Yeah.
So I'd say keep it simple, but that's your general thing, 2 to 3 times.
Well, I appreciate your help.
Well, you are welcome, and now we've simplified your life, you see?
Absolutely.
All kinds of things happen on the Splendid Table. Hey, Leslie, thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy the morels.
I do. Bye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question's about abalone. Aside from $35 a plate in a restaurant, what else is precious about abalone? We'll have that answer in a moment and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, aside from costing $35 a plate in a restaurant, what else is precious about the abalone shellfish? Well, it's the shell. Abalone's iridescent shell is one of the sources for mother of pearl, a.k.a. sea opal. Now, it's used in all kinds of jewelry and even in fancy furniture inlay. New Zealand's ancient peoples used to use it in mystical carvings, and so did the ancient Asians. In fact, many ocean cultures totally ignored pearls in favor of mother of pearl from the seashells. And it's no wonder, because abalone comes in these incredible colors, gold, red, pink, silver, a purple that practically pulses, and a poison green that shimmers. Now, my favorite mother of pearl lore is its other name, the Mother's Day Stone. And supposedly it has all the attributes of a good mom: charity, protection against evil, healing, it enhances personal integrity, and it helps wash away negativity. So if you get the shell along with your $35 a plate abalone, consider it a bargain. Okay, let's get back to your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have got Mary on the line from Claremont, California. Hey, Mary, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're more than welcome.
Since when my kids got older, I've gone back to art school, and I'm having a show at a local museum gallery.
Congratulations. What do you do?
I'm sculpting and doing pottery. The show will be sculpture.
Oh, this is wonderful.
And prior to the opening reception, I wanted to have a cocktail party. And so I need to prep things in advance that I can assemble in a few hours with some of my other artist friends.
About how many people are you thinking about?
Probably 50.
Okay, okay. You know, I'm a firm believer in situations like this of you think big, you think lush, and you think let your guests do the work, but you never tell them that.
Oh, that's
and no, but this is what I mean, in the sense that you do wonderful looking presentations of interestingly cut hunks of cheese.
Okay.
That maybe you have surrounded by kale and flowers, or if you want to do the minimalist kind of thing, you get slates, you know, like floor
yes.
slate.
Yes.
And each cheese has its own piece of slate that
oh,
it's
wonderful.
Sitting on. And you have baskets of crackers and flatbreads that you've broken and allowed them to really almost be sculptural.
Yes.
And the other thing you can do to go with those cheeses, you know, you would have something, I'm thinking of variety, like you would have something very mild and creamy, like maybe a goat cheese you've mixed with dried cranberry, or a San Andre, which is sort of what I think of as the everyman's kind of cheese. Everybody loves it. Yeah. You'd have something aged like you're in California, like a Vella Dry Jack, or maybe a really good cheddar, or a Spanish Mahon. You know, something that has that nutty character. And then you might have something that's kind of funky, like a Brie or a Humboldt Fog, which is a blue cheese from Northern California,
yeah.
or a Camembert. But the idea is each one is set up in a way that, you know, it's the shape and it's the whole aesthetic of it that's beautiful. And then everybody helps themselves. And then you can have little pots of sweet things to balance with the cheeses, which is a big deal now. You know, everybody's doing these sort of super sweet preserves, a very old idea. So you could do things like candied orange peels that you know, could be around. Or you could even do something like a chutney. These are all coming out of jars, you know, out of the store.
Okay.
Along with that idea, you might have baskets of things like just the tops of pencil slim asparagus, like the top 2 inches.
Okay.
You know, you put those in little cups almost, that they're clustered very tightly, and next to them, maybe you just have something very simple, like a fresh cheese that's been blended with lots of fresh herbs and red onion. And the idea is you just run the top of that raw asparagus. All you've had to do is cut them right through that creamy mixture.
Right.
And it's a nice crunch, and it's not going to be drippy and messy all over the place. You know what else is beautiful to do? If you can get your hands on good cherry tomatoes, which sometimes you can off season.
Yeah, I can.
Get a big tray or just a white, shallow, rectangular or round dish with a very low rim on it.
Uh-huh.
Pave it with black beans and then pile cherry tomatoes on top of those black beans.
Oh.
And you see the simplicity of this?
Yeah.
You know, you're not doing anything except really the arranging and selecting the interesting flavors.
Great.
And you could have, you know, some Spanish almonds around and that kind of thing. But this way, it's very dramatic, it's very exciting, and it's delicious.
Sounds fabulous.
Yeah. And all your artistic vision goes into this, so it's like a wonderful prelude to actually seeing your sculpture.
Thank you.
Hey, you're welcome, and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You take care.
You too. Bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us 800-537-5252. We've got Lynn calling from Nashville. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. I'm really happy to talk to you today.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, I was at a dinner party a couple of months ago.
Uh-huh.
And one of the ladies there brought up the fact that she, about 30 years ago, had a recipe for James Beard's black fruit cake. And she said, I had a recipe for it, and I've lost it, can't find it.
Uh-huh.
And she said, I just remember that I made it once, and it was very, you know, a lot of ingredients in it, and it was great, and I'd just love to find it. And I thought perhaps you all would have some idea of where we could find that.
You know, I was a great fan of James Beard's, mm-hmm. and I actually met him, and I collected everything I could of his, and that cake, I think I made that cake years ago as Christmas gifts. It was a great fruit cake, but you marinated a whole bunch of candied fruits in booze of some kind, cognac or brandy, for 2 days in the refrigerator. And I think it might have been that recipe, because I remember that idea struck me as being so good. What could be bad after you've started with that concept? There's a couple of places that I would look. This may mean a trip to the library, but one of them would be in his American Cookery book, which was a big book that he did, and it came out, I want to say, in the late 60s.
Okay.
And the other place, now he, you know, he did a newspaper column for years, and it may have appeared in the columns.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't know where one would find those. But the other thing that he did, and it's a charming read, is a biography, an autobiography called Delights and Prejudices. And it's the story of his life. And I know there were a lot of old-time Christmas recipes in that book. It was the story of his life, but it was with a lot of recipes.
Okay.
And I'm hard-pressed. My memory is saying I think I found the recipe in that book.
Oh, that sounds great.
And the book is Delights and Prejudices. And it's one of those things I love to pull out and read, you know, again. So see if you can find a copy of that and a copy of American Cookery. And
I'm sure I could find either of those probably on one of the internet book search sites.
Well, you know, yeah, and the thing is, because they'll always be secondhand books, they will not be wildly expensive.
Right.
And you'll love them.
I think I'll enjoy those even if they don't have the recipe.
Exactly.
For black fruit cake.
Yeah, because his recipes were so good, and they stand up. They're as good today as they were when he wrote them.
Right.
So I'd say those would be two places I would look.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And hopefully I'll find this. And if I do, I'll make some and let you know how it is.
Okay. We'll look forward to that.
Great.
Hey, Lynn, thanks.
Thank you.
You take care.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. That's how you get a hold of us. Okay. Who's up next? We've got Amy is calling from Phoenix. Hey, Amy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I am a high school teacher, and one of my students brought me an ostrich egg.
Oh, just, you mean out of the blue?
right now I guess they're laying eggs, and he brought a bunch of them in for a bunch of the teachers, and I don't know what to do with it. I hollowed the one out I have now, and I just hollowed it out, and I painted it, and it's in my living room. But I want to know, what can I do to cook it instead of just making, like, scrambled eggs? Or?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, first of all, do you know that the ostrich egg was one of the things that was really highly prized during the Renaissance and afterward, and they would make cups out of it. You know, they'd use the egg because it was from such an exotic creature and from exotic lands.
Mm-hmm.
These incredibly elaborate gold and silver cups would be built around an ostrich egg. So your painted ostrich egg is sort of celebrating the same idea.
It's very thick. It's like porcelain. It's like a quarter of an inch thick.
Yeah, yeah. Now, okay, what do you do with ostrich egg? I'm going to think now. I've eaten them. They're a little richer than chicken eggs, but they're about the same. How big are the eggs going? I mean, give me a basic size.
It's probably about 10 inches tall.
Yeah. That's going to be equal to maybe a dozen to a dozen and a half
eggs.
Yeah,
that's what I was told. It has more white than yolk, though. The yolk is not a dozen worth of yolk.
It's more white?
Yeah.
You know what might be great fun to do is, you know, to do like a baked omelet with it.
Uh-huh.
And maybe if you can, it must be very hard to open that egg, right?
Well, the one that I have now, I had to use my boyfriend's drill to drill out the end, and then I shook it over a bowl. What I was told was that it will actually shatter and not just crack like a chicken egg, so you have to, like, pound it against the cupboard and have someone hold a bowl under it.
Maybe
so
this
it's
is
not like a one-person making breakfast for themselves job.
you know what I'm thinking? I know you said you don't want to do scrambled eggs, but let me throw out an idea.
Okay.
Years ago, a very famous French chef would take regular chicken eggs and he'd take off just like the top quarter of the egg and he'd sterilize the egg, you know, put boiling water in it. And then he would do a very, very slow scramble with the eggs with a fresh cheese. I would use cream cheese because it's like nothing on earth. And a little cream. I mean, this is lush. This is really lush. And you just cook it very slowly over medium-low heat until it comes together and makes something that looks like scrambled eggs. And you throw in any kind of fresh herb that you like,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I would serve it in the halves of the ostrich egg. I think that would be the coolest thing.
It would be. I'd have to use a saw.
No, but however you get that egg open, uh-huh. Even if the pieces don't match.
Right.
I think it would be so great. You'd have something, the ostrich egg is that sort of creamy white color, right? You'd have the golden eggs, and you could throw in some chicken yolks, you know, if you want to get them more golden. And you would have a bit of the cream cheese and the cream, which would make it very lush, and then spotted with green herbs, and you'd serve it in this egg, and you could just set it into a dish or something. I think it would be great.
It is the most awesome-looking thing I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, I'd celebrate the egg, and scrambling is a great way to do it.
I let it watch TV with me.
Have you named the egg?
No, it's egg.
Oh, it's just egg?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I think that's enough identity. It's so distinctive.
Yeah, there's not another one in the house, though.
Amy, thanks for our laugh
of
the week.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Now, if you see Amy walking her egg in Phoenix, you'll understand. Control is an illusion. That's one of my favorite T-shirt sayings. Well, in the world of wine, control isn't something to joke about. Lack of it can be very expensive. Grapes, weather, and climate are anything but controllable. Enter Leo McCloskey and his company Enologics. Now, Enologics is a tech company for winemakers. It claims that it can give a wine a higher national critics score. Enologics President Leo McCloskey is on the phone. Leo, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Leo, how can you assure a higher score for a wine?
By tracking wine quality, it's possible to predict before the winemaker conducts the winemaking operation, let's say fermentation,
yeah,
during the harvest, what the outcome is going to be. Now, a smart winemaker who knows the outcome is going to be poor might change the way he manages a batch of grapes from year to year. It allows him to work logistically, that is, to change the outcome.
But how do you do that?
Well, I just had this case yesterday up in the Alexander Valley where the winemaker had a low-quality wine,
mm-hmm.
and he had a high-quality wine.
Right.
And he asked me, the owner actually asked me, how is it that we have high and low quality out of the same vineyard block? And I said, I think it's the temperature of the fermentation, because you can diagnose these issues. They tend to be the same problems over and over. And so we walked out to the crush pad, which is the area where they actually take the grapes from the vineyard and put them in the tank.
Right.
And we saw that, yes, the wine with low quality was fermented at a cold temperature, whereas the wine with high quality was fermented at a high temperature.
Now, you evidently have like a library of references of things that create flavors in wines. And this is the service that you sell to vineyards. Have I got that right?
The service we sell is membership to a fully hosted online application for winemaking. That's software.
Uh-huh.
And the key thing it does is model blends. It makes a digital model of what the quality, what the descriptors are for the wine before you ever make a wine. And then we offer metrics, which are quality metrics,
mm-hmm.
that are producer-based, winery-based metrics that reflect winemakers' tastes. We'll predict winemakers' tastes using chemical analysis. And then we provide consulting.
So you can essentially say to someone, "We can design with your land and your grapes, we can design a wine for you."
No, I'm saying more along the lines of what's happening in the Silicon Valley, that I have a solution. The way IBM has a solution, Siebel Systems has a solution
right.
for business. I'm saying that we have a large solution to the largest problem in the winemaking industry, which is how do you protect quality and style when you increase volume?
Mm-hmm.
Not how do you make it homogeneous, but how do you actually predict it? California winemakers do not know how to scale both quality and volume as well as the French, and that's where we come in. We can help a California winemaker understand how can you protect quality, the type of quality Robert Parker is talking about, James
mm-hmm.
Lowby at the Wine Spectator, and many, many others.
It seems to take some of the spontaneity out of the process, though, doesn't it?
Well, it could be, but that's a slam. You know, I think one of the things that the media does is the media is beholden to the idea that the sine qua non of fine wine is that it's a complete mystery. But that's sort of utter nonsense. It's not that mysterious.
Well, how has it worked for you? I mean, have your clients gotten their scores raised?
You know, we have 75 brands we work with at 60 companies with 250 winemakers that
uh-huh.
we work with. Not one single company in Napa Valley is not rated 90 points.
Leo Michalowski, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Leo Michalowski is president of Enologix. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He said, "Men lose their tempers in defending their taste." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it right on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our music is by Billy Barber. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.